The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the recordings of the 2016 ACOI Internal Medicine Board Review course. The course was held March 30th through April 3rd, 2016 at the Renaissance Resort at SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida. It features nationally known speakers covering topics of interest to the physician preparing for initial certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Rheumatoid arthritis is presented by Dr. Robert DiGiovanni.
So, anyway, this first lecture is going to be on the presentation of treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. I have no financial disclosures to make regarding this. The only disclosure I'll make is that slides have been updated for me by my junior fellow, Rocky Shaw, DO, so we'll have some up-to-date slides for 2016. I did not put my contact information on here. That was my mistake, but I'm on the ACOI board. If you go to the website, if you have any questions, I'm right there. You can email me and I'll get back to you with any answers you require. So my contact information is all there on the ACOI website. Learning objectives for this lecture. We're going to understand how rheumatoid arthritis is diagnosed, hopefully. We're going to talk about early treatment and use of our best therapies up front. Look at some of the extra-articular manifestations of rheumatoid arthritis and recognize treatment strategies that are used. And hopefully be able to be familiar with some of the disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs and biologic agents that are currently available for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. Of course, there are numerous different forms of diseases that cause joint inflammation. Rheumatoid arthritis may or may not be the most common. Inflammatory arthritis, spondyloarthropathies may actually exceed that based on new diagnostic criteria, but certainly it's one of the best recognized forms of inflammatory arthritis. Prevalence is somewhat up to 1% of the general population. Estimates of its prevalence, probably about 2 million cases in the United States. China and Japan, somewhat less, but Native Americans, quite a bit higher, about 5%, leading to theories of the Columbian Exchange, where rheumatoid arthritis, which did not exist prior to the 1700s in Europe, occurred in epidemic proportion in the mid-1700s after the exchange of such things as sugar and tobacco. And we know that tobacco causes citrullinization of arginine residues, so you get these anti-citrulline antibodies, and that with gingival disease and the gut microbiome are a right place for autoantibodies to form. So total incidence is 40 per 100,000. Mortality, about 40% of all deaths in patients with rheumatoid arthritis, is as a result of cardiovascular disease. And in 2009, there were over 15,000 hospitalizations with RA as the primary diagnosis. The most common onset is insidious, but we can see an explosive onset with 30 plus joints. We can see atypical, where it may just be a monarthritis. There may be polymyalgia rheumatica-like onset in late onset rheumatoid arthritis, what we call LORA now. People in their fifth and sixth decades to get RA, it may look just like PMR. And then palindromic rheumatism is an older term for a waxing and waning type of synovitis of the wrists. Has to be witnessed by the physician to make that diagnosis. Now, any diarthroidal joint in the body can be affected, and here's our friend, the well-known rheumatology homunculus, that gives us a good distinction between rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis, and we can see that almost any diarthroidal joint can be involved in RA, where it does seem to spare the axial skeleton with the exception of the cervical spine, and I'm going to mention that again. Whereas osteoarthritis, we see the DIP, PIP joints, the basal joints of the thumbs, the bunion joints, knees, hips, and of course anywhere the axial skeleton can be affected. Large joint involvement such as hip occurs in about 1 in 5 patients, as you can see here. Here is the one exception where axial skeletal involvement occurs in rheumatoid arthritis, and that is in the cervical spine. So this is why you don't want to do OMT on a patient with RA, and as far as their pre-op evaluation is concerned, you want to get lateral flexion extension views on these patients to see if they have atlantoaxial subluxation, because these patients would be either an awake intubation or intubation over a endoscope. Otherwise, they could wake up a quadriplegic. So you've got to be careful with that. They get synovitis at the transverse ligament of the odontoid. And as you can see here, the odontoid, when they tilt their head forward, which is the position you're going to put them in at intubation, they can sublux. The disease spares the lumbar and thoracic joints, so ordering a rheumatoid factor in someone with low back pain is a low-yield test. Rheumatoid arthritis is a prototypical systemic disease. It is an inflammatory arthritis. We characterize it by the way it affects joints. Joint swelling is fusiform, typically, very apparent of the PIP joints. It occurs with prolonged morning stiffness and a gelling phenomenon. So when any prolonged inactivity, the joint fluid stiffens up, just like Jell-O. And then with use, they feel better. They limber up. They may get metatarsalgia, widening of the forefoot, and constitutional symptoms such as fever, malaise, myalgias, loss of appetite, and weight loss. So it is a systemic disease. This is synovitis of the hand. This is from the ACR slide bank. Anybody can go to the ACR slide bank. You don't have to be a member of the American College of Rheumatology, and you can look at all kinds of great pictures like this. You won't be able to download them unless you join as a member. Then you can download them for free. These are the 1987 criteria. They're a little busy. Don't feel bad. I grew up with the 1958 criteria, which were much worse. So there are 7 diagnostic criteria. 4 or more gives you a classification of rheumatoid arthritis. And this is for the purpose of inclusion into drug studies. Notice what the diagnostic criteria are. For example, morning stiffness of 1 hour is assigned the same weight as a positive rheumatoid factor. So you can see that it really is a clinical diagnosis. But anyway, 4 or more of those diagnostic criteria give you a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, and they have to be present for 6 weeks. The problem with these criteria, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them because now we have newer criteria, which I'm going to show you, is that they lacked sensitivity in early disease and therefore delayed treatment. So we have kind of done away with those and gone to this point system now. So I don't know if you would ever see something like this on a board exam, but I think it's fair. It's a fair question. Now with this point distribution, for example, you can see 1 large joint doesn't get you any points. 2 to 10 large joints might get you a point. 1 to 3 small joints get you 2 points, and so on. Serology, if you have negative rheumatoid factor, negative ACPA, which is the anti-citrullinated peptide antibody. You could also, many of your labs probably call that anti-CCP antibodies. If they're negative, you get no points. Low positive for either, you get 2 points. High positive for either, 3 points. So symptom duration, more than 6 weeks, you get a point, and so forth. And they have finally included C-reactive protein and sedimentation rate in the diagnostic criteria, which makes a lot of sense because they're very helpful tests. If you have more than 6 points, you have definite RA. What if the score is less than 6? Well, prospectively, they may eventually fulfill those criteria. Or if you look back through their records, retrospectively, they may fulfill those criteria as well. So they don't all have to occur at the exact same moment in time. Serologies, the 2 serologies that have emerged as important in the diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis are the IgM rheumatoid factor, and there are other rheumatoid factors, of course, but the IgM rheumatoid factor is the important one, and all IgM rheumatoid factor is a IgM autoantibody has an affinity for the Fc portion of IgG. So you develop these immune complex of IgG and IgM together. That's all they are. 70% of people with RA are positive at onset, with 10 to 15% more becoming positive within the first 2 years. I'll mention that rheumatoid factor can become positive 10 years before the onset of the disease. So again, not a screening test in an asymptomatic group of patients. There's no reason to do it on a physical exam. Positive rheumatoid factor without clinical features of RA may be seen in other underlying disease. 50% of Hep C patients will have positive rheumatoid factors. Two-thirds of them will have positive ANAs and cryoglobulin. So don't forget to screen these patients then for hepatitis if they come up with a positive rheumatoid factor. Of course, we can see it in lupus, Sjogren's, bacterial endocarditis, and don't forget that, you know, it's part of the Duke Minor criteria as well. The ACPA, or anti-citrullinated peptide antibody, has come on strong in the past 10 years, highly specific, 98% specificity, so that's got much less false positive tests than the rheumatoid factor. And it's seen in about two-thirds of the patients who are rheumatoid factor positive, and it portends a very aggressive and erosive disease when you see high titers of the ACPA antibody. A third of patients with RA are ANA positive. So don't get confused by that. You know, you say, oh my gosh, this patient must have lupus, and doctors tell their patients they have lupus, but a third of them are ANA positive. Extra-articular manifestations occur in nearly 50% of patients during the course of the disease, and it can involve really, it's protean, almost like lupus, where it can involve any organ system. The most common is Sjogren's syndrome, secondary Sjogren's syndrome, occurring in over a third of patients. So if they come in with dry eyes, dry mouth, and so forth, that's most likely a secondary Sjogren's. Let's talk about some of the extra-articular manifestations. Skin involvement, rheumatoid nodules are seen in about 25%, firm, non-tender, sometimes adherent to underlying periosteum, common over the extensor surfaces of the forearms, and always associated with positive rheumatoid factor. So this is an always in medicine. Rheumatoid factor has to be positive to get a positive rheumatoid factor, to get positive rheumatoid nodules. Methotrexate, which of course is our number one used medicine for rheumatoid arthritis in the United States, for some people with nodulosis, it's like fertilizer for the nodules. So if they're developing nodules, and they can develop these in the lungs as well, you got to look at some other type of treatment than methotrexate for this individual. The pathology is always classic, three-layer nodule. So if these occur in the lungs and you take one out, this is what they look like, a central area fibrinoid necrosis, followed by this palisade of histiocytes, and then a loose stroma of connective tissue and lymphocytes and plasma cells on the outside layer. Always the same. Pyoderma gangrenosum, this is one of the febrile neutrophilic dermatoses and occurs in rheumatoid arthritis. Can also be seen in ulcerative colitis and myeloma. When this occurs, it looks the same way, these ulcerative lesions, not over pressure sites, with these black overhanging edges. And this is treated with steroids, okay? And you might see these in Felty syndrome as well. Pericarditis is a common occurrence in rheumatoid arthritis. The pathologist back in my day used to call it bread and butter pericarditis, because on autopsy, the two layers of the pericardium, was when you took them apart, it was like two pieces of bread with butter in the middle. It was like a, you know, kind of a smegma kind of looking thing. So it was an exudative bread and butter pericarditis. And accelerated atherosclerosis, we recognize now, is actually very common as an independent risk factor. We might see a twofold increased risk in cardiovascular disease in women who have rheumatoid arthritis and lupus for that matter. Pleurisy, with or without effusion, occurs in up to 50% of patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Pleural effusions occur in about 2-3%, and one of the questions that is fair game on an exam is the glucose in that fluid, and it is exquisitely low, typically less than 10 milligrams per cent. So that's a tip-off. It may be very similar to a empyema type of infusion, exudative with very low pH, but extremely low blood, extremely low sugar. Okay, so that's if you see that on a board, that's a very common type of question. 30% will have parenchymal lung disease, pulmonary nodules, parenchymal nodules, what we used to call necrobiotic nodules. These are essentially rheumatoid nodules, and again, associated with rheumatoid factor. Interstitial pulmonary fibrosis is common, usually starts in the bases. That's more common in men who have had the disease for 10 plus years. bronchiectasis, and now we see cryptogenic organizing pneumonia, what we used to call BOOP, in these individuals. I think it was more common when we were using gold injections and D-penicillamine, but it can still be seen. Felty syndrome, everybody knows what this triad is. It's rheumatoid arthritis that is seropositive, splenomegaly, and neutropenia. Neutropenia, not leukopenia, but neutropenia. And the positive rheumatoid factor is typically very high. They're like super rheumatoids, I like to think of them, with very high rheumatoid factors. Very common question that we see, very high rheumatoid factors. They are virtually all HLA-DR4 positive, which, you know, these are the worst of the RA patients. Splenectomy has gone out of favor. Methotrexate's the drug of choice. It seems counterintuitive to give somebody a drug that could cause bone marrow suppression that has Felty syndrome, but it's the drug of choice. You have to be real careful when you use something like Neupogen, because if you overshoot the mark, if you get a very high neutrophil count, you can cause a vasculitis in these individuals. Normocytic, normochromic anemia is very common. Anemia of chronic inflammation. My patients with RA typically live around 10 or 11 grams of hemoglobin. You'll go nuts trying to figure it out. Of course, we put them on methotrexate, and their MCV and MCH go up, because what is methotrexate but an anti-metabolite? So you get a maturation defect of red blood cells, and as a result, microcytic type of anemia. But their B12 and folic acid always comes back normal. Don't let it drive you crazy, but don't miss, you know, a tumor in the colon that's bleeding. I often say if you have a patient that's on an NSAID and they've got heme positive stools and you have one test to get, what would it be? It's a colonoscopy, because statistically 26% of them will have colon cancer. Hepatic, you can see nonspecific transaminitis. Alkaline phosphatase is an acute phase reactant. Typically of hepatic origin in patients with RA. So very active RA patients, you may see elevated alkaline phosphatase. Neurologic, you might see peripheral neuropathies, carpal tunnel syndrome. If you get AA subluxation, you're going to see long tract diseases. You're going to see a bowel and bladder incontinence, upgoing toes, because that's an upper motor neuron lesion. All right. If you have bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome, you might want to think of amyloidosis, secondary amyloidosis. So if these patients go for a carpal tunnel release, tell the surgeon, send any tissue you take out of the wrists for Congo red staining, because they may have amyloid. Vasculitis can occur, and it could be anything from a little digital vasculitis to a systemic necrotizing vasculitis. Muscular atrophy, myositis could occur in these individuals. They could occur in connective tissue disease with anti-RNP antibodies as well. And let's see, we don't use D-penicillamine very much anymore, but that used to have the unique side effect of myasthenia gravis. And you can see a low-grade membranous glomerulonephropathy, particularly if they develop amyloidosis. Early treatment. Okay, so radiographic progression of rheumatoid arthritis is found to occur within the first 2 years. We used to think that it didn't occur until later in disease. We have studies now that you can refer to, such as the BEST study and the TICORA study, was the tight control of rheumatoid arthritis. So with these studies in mind, we use our best treatments up front, our best therapies up front. Just like if you went to a doctor with cancer, and if he said, well, we're going to use an okay treatment, and then if that doesn't work for in a year or two, we'll use a more potent medication, you'd want a second opinion. And it's the same thing with RA. The incidence of joint replacement surgery and things of that nature have really diminished since we've started with this type of protocol. Okay, traditional DMARDs, disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs. The only drug on this list that was actually invented for rheumatoid arthritis is the first one, sulfasalazine. This was developed in 1939 at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. And it was a combination of sulfapyridine and 5-aminosalicylic acid linked by an azo bond. and they reasoned that RA is an infectious disease, so we'll give them a sulfa drug and an anti-inflammatory. And actually, it was very effective, but it fell by the wayside in 1950 when steroids were synthesized in a lab. Of course, we know it's used a lot in inflammatory bowel disease, where the sulfapyridine acts as a vehicle to get aspirin into the gut. But believe it or not, in 1997, the FDA, some 60 years after it was first invented, approved sulfasalazine for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. Methotrexate has become our number one used medicine for the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. So if you see anything like that on a board, this is the most popular medicine because it is extremely effective with the most benefit for the most people, the fewest side effects, and least cost. Very excellent medication. Of course, it's an anti-metabolite, it's a folic acid analog, but this may not be the way how it works in rheumatoid arthritis, because we can give them folic acid 1 milligram a day to prevent side effects from methotrexate, and it doesn't affect the efficacy of the methotrexate. What you should know in general internal medicine or in the hospital setting, you don't want to give these patients anything with trimethoprim in it, sulfatrimethoprim, because trimethoprim and methotrexate together can cause an agranulocytosis. So important drug-drug interaction there, methotrexate and trimethoprim. Leflunomide came out in 1998 as a pyrimidine synthetase inhibitor, fairly effective medication. Like the biologicals now, it has a black box warning of reactivation of pulmonary tuberculosis, so you have to make sure that these patients are pre-screened for TB. Azathioprine is approved for rheumatoid arthritis, Imuran, not super effective. Hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil has been around since 1945. Somebody took it for their malaria and serendipitously was discovered to be an effective treatment for rheumatoid arthritis. Cyclosporin A, specifically a microemulsion called Neoral, was approved way back in the early 90s for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. And it's an effective medicine, but a cumbersome drug to use. I like our fellows to be skilled in the use of it, but I wouldn't recommend you start slinging that drug around, because it can cause hypertension, renal insufficiency, hirsutism, agitation, a lot of side effects of that particular drug potentially. All right, the biologicals, these have changed the way we treat rheumatoid arthritis. We have the anti-tumor necrosis factor alpha drugs that are on the market. There's five of them. The first one, Enbrel, came out in 97. It's the only one that's a receptor antagonist a soluble receptor. The rest are monoclonal antibodies, Remicade, Humira, Simponi, and Cimzia are all available. These are extremely effective medicines and have done a great job with early treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. Orencia or abatacept, that came out in 2005. It inhibits a co-stimulatory signal to T lymphocytes, CD4 lymphocytes in the treatment of RA. Very effective. Now we have B-cell depleting therapy. So some of you may recognize the drug Rituxan or rituximab, which was initially approved for treatment of B-cell lymphomas, but is actually an effective treatment for rheumatoid arthritis. And as I'll mention later, has been approved for ANCA-associated vasculitis as well. We have a couple now interleukin 6 inhibitors. The tocilizumab is the first one on the market, and sarilumab has just been approved, I think, and we'll be seeing that eventually. And now we have these targeted small molecule non-biologic biologics coming out. And the first one that's been on the market is Xeljanz, which is tofacitinib. And you may see NIBs, which are these intracellular signaling inhibitors, in a lots of different walks of life. You'll see them in oncology, for example. But these are small molecules that target the cytokine signals way downstream, much further down in the inflammatory response. And they're oral medications as a result, but they cost just as much as the biologicals. Nebraska triple therapy is a combination. You may see this from your insurance company. This is one of these stupid fail first combinations that you have to fail it in order to go on a biological. They have to have methotrexate, sulfasalazine, hydroxychloroquine. I mean, it's so funny what these insurance companies do. I just had one patient that we haven't had on a DMARD in a number of years. He doesn't need it anymore, so they want me to change his diagnosis. I said, well, he's still got the disease. He just doesn't need a DMARD. So they come up with all these things. But Nebraska triple therapy can be effective treatment for some people. Okay. We've added in some slides for osteoarthritis. It is the most common form of joint disease in human. It was only 100 years ago that it was actually distinguished from other forms of arthritis as being a hypertrophic form of synovial damage. There can be atrophic arthritis with periarticular osteoporosis and erosive changes in cartilage loss, and as opposed to osteoarthritis, which is hypertrophic arthritis with cartilage loss associated with increase in bone density, so, and bone formation around the joint. So it's a bony reparative change that's occurring in osteoarthritis. It's uncommon under the age of 40. Rapidly rises in prevalence by the age of 70, such that most people will have osteoarthritis in some joint after the age of 70. Over 75% of people over the age of 75 have X-ray evidence of the disease, and over 75% are symptomatic. There are variable risk factors. Increasing age obviously increases your risk of OA at all sites. Female sex or gender are some sites, particularly knees and hands in women, increase in risk. Race and ethnicity may be a risk factor. It's much more common in whites and blacks and rare in Asians. Obesity causes knee-predominant osteoarthritis, and trauma and repetitive activity can cause site-specific osteoarthritis. For example, jackhammer arthropathy of the shoulders, or a seamstress who develops osteoarthritis of the hands, etc. Here's our friend, the famous homunculus again. And you can see the joints that are involved in OA. Not every diarthroidal joint is very subject to it. Rare in joints like the shoulders and ankles, but common in the hips, knees, spinal joints, the basal joints of the thumbs, PIP and DIP joints. So that's a common distinguisher between RA and OA. RA being the MCP and PIPs, OA being PIP and DIPs, sparing the MCPs. Of course, the bunion joints as well. Osteoarthritis is common to see use-related pain in this disease. Basically, inflammatory arthritis is better with use. Osteoarthritis is worse with use. There's a relatively short-lasting stiffness or gelling effect, so when they get up in the morning, they may just have some stiffness lasting a few minutes, but not the half hour, hour, or plus that we see in rheumatoid arthritis. There is mild to moderate firm swelling on physical exam, palpable crepitation on range of motion of the joints, restricted range of motion. There may be warmth and effusions, muscle wasting from disuse around that joint, and deformity and instability of the involved joint. Most cases can be diagnosed by history and clinical findings. Radiograph and MRI will also demonstrate these. Main radiographic feature is irregular joint space narrowing and bony reparative change, such as osteophytosis, subchondral cyst-like change, subchondral eburnation of the bone. So with rheumatoid arthritis, you don't see much of a bony reparative response. With osteoarthritis, you see an aggressive bony reparative response. The synovial fluid from osteoarthritis tends to be a bland, non-inflammatory fluid. This is a typical X-ray of patient with there's a normal knee, and then you can see osteoarthritis where the joint's narrowed just at the medial aspect with osteophyte formation. And osteophyte formation, again, is a feature of OA, not RA. There are subsets of RA. You may have primary versus secondary, as we mentioned, localized or generalized, atrophic or hypertrophic. Some forms can be somewhat inflammatory and respond nicely to intra-articular steroids. You may see chondrocalcinosis in some of these joints, and of course they vary very much on the rate of progression. And the pathogenesis, we'll mention quickly, it seems to be where age, overuse, the presence of various cytokines, metalloproteases increase, resulting in a decrease in chondrocyte matrix and maintenance of the cartilage. So a lot of research going on in this right now. Here are the actual current recommendations from the American College of Rheumatology for the management of OA of the knee. Education, weight loss, aerobic exercise, PTOT, physical devices, patella taping and bracing, appropriate footwear and joint protection. Next we get to pharmacologic, acetaminophen. You can skip that, doesn't usually work. COX-2 selective, NSAIDs, non-acetylated salicylates, and other analgesics. And along the side, we see intra-articular steroids and hyaluron supplements. Topically, we can use capsaicin, methyl salicylate, and there's a lot of compounding shops that make topicals for osteoarthritis. Finally, surgical intervention or joint replacement surgery.